everybody. Welcome back to The Undiscovered You, a podcast for people who feel like they have so much more to offer, but are somehow stuck where they are. I'm your host, Kimberly Johnston, and this season, we're talking all about balancing on the seesaw. It's about finding that balance between life and work and life outside of work. Today, I have with me Ruth Estelle, who is 80% of the time a professional triathlete and 20% of the time is working as a financial institution. Ruth, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's just get started from the beginning. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up, what life was like, and how you ended up getting to be a triathlete. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, definitely not something I would have said when I'm younger, that's what I want to be, or had any kind of inkling that I might be able to be sort of a professional athlete. Yeah, I guess I grew up in Essex. I'm one of four, so there was a very healthy competitive vibe between the siblings. We were all pretty active. I think, you know, our parents kind of encouraged us to be outside a lot, get involved in as many sporting hobbies that we could. My main sport kind of all through school and uni was hockey, and I was never particularly good. Like, I definitely didn't have particularly great skills, but I could run around quite a lot. So I think endurance has probably always been my strength more than anything skill-wise or speed. But yeah, I think throughout school and uni, really enjoyed having that sort of competitive element, something quite regularly to have hockey matches to focus on, obviously the social element as well. And when I left uni and I started my job with Lloyds on the graduate program, on my second rotation, that's when I moved to London. And I was actually working in the Charity of the Year team at the time. And they had a couple of spaces left at the London Triathlon. And they sort of said to me, they're like, do you fancy doing it? So I think I'd been doing a bit of running. I was actually training for the Berlin Marathon at the time. Hadn't really been doing anything that serious sporting wise post leaving uni, but had been keeping fit. And I thought, yeah, why not? Like, I know how to swim. That wasn't particularly good, but I was like, I know how to. I'd done like a little bit of bike riding, probably like the last couple of years of uni. I had quite a lot of cousins that were really into it. So we'd had like a few family weekends where people went riding together. Like, my parents actually moved up to the Lake District and we did a whole family cycle from the Lake District down to Wales. And I mean, we got rained on for 3 days, so it wasn't particularly fun, but I'd done like a little bit of cycling, and obviously I was doing a fair bit of running. So I thought, I'll give it a go. Really enjoyed it. I think just the whole, there's something about that triathlon atmosphere. I think partly it's the, I guess, like the equality of it, in the like everyone's doing the same thing, like men, women, the pros, the age groupers, like you're all on the same course. It's like, it feels very inclusive. But I think also because of that, it then also feels really supportive. So like, there was definitely a really nice vibe of, you know, I was saying to people on the start line, this is my first triathlon. You know, the amount of people trying to give tips and kind of say, yeah, like, just have a little think about this, do this. So like, just the whole atmosphere I loved. And off the back of it, I was like, oh, maybe I'll join my local tri club. Because I also thought then I can make some friends. I was still at that point of London of like, I don't know that many people. So that seemed like a good way to kind of meet people. And that was kind of the whole spark that, yeah, kind of from there, I started doing some of the local races and then start hearing about being able to represent your country. And I was like, oh my God, like, I could, you know, actually represent GB. How cool is that? And it kind of all basically spiraled from that, of getting into the tri club and then finding all these people that were going off and doing all these, you know, crazy races that I thought at the time, like, especially the idea of doing an Ironman. I was like, that's way too far. Like, I'll never do that. And then, yeah, bring on 2017 when I did my first Ironman. And then got to the point where at the end of 2019, I was like, oh, I think I could maybe actually be a pro. So, yeah, crazy journey.
I think my favorite part of the story is, yeah, I could swim. So, you know, why not do a triathlon? I can swim, Ruth. I'm not going to be doing a triathlon, just to be clear.
Okay. So, you should give it a go. It's fun.
I did one half marathon. I think that's probably my max. Berlin. You were getting ready to train for a marathon in Berlin. So was that your first long distance run, or what had you done before that?
Yeah, that was definitely, I must have done a couple of half marathons up to that point. But yeah, Berlin was the first. And it's actually still the only standalone marathon that I've done. So
fun fact.
All the other all the other marathons I've done have been at the end of an Ironman. So yeah. And I was doing it with my partner at the time and his dad. So yeah, it was like a kind of fun family-ish outing to go and do it. And it's a really good one. I think in terms of like things to do that is a nice sort of holiday as well as something active, I think marathons are usually actually a really good way of seeing different parts of the city, which might sound a bit, you know, like you could obviously just go and walk around, but there is also something really cool about being part of this mass event with, like, you know, those big marathons usually have about 20,000 people, like pretty special. Yeah, I'd highly recommend going off and doing city marathons just as a good way of sightseeing.
Yeah, it's like you can either take a tour bus or you can run 26 miles. Totally up to you what you feel like doing.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, do you find the running easy? Like, is it something, so, you know, this was your first long distance run in terms of over, and you did the half marathons. Did you find it quite easy to do?
No, I don't think marathons are ever easy. And I think the training, run training is definitely the one that I'd say struggle with just from an injury perspective. Like, it's obviously like pretty much the most hard wearing on your body. I think trying to get the balance between doing enough to be in your best shape versus not doing too much to get injured, that's quite challenging. But I think on the other hand, running is also the easiest because you just need a pair of trainers and you can kind of do it anywhere. And
And some chafing gel. You cannot run long.
All the chafing gel everywhere.
All of it everywhere.
Yeah. But I think it's definitely like, I think marathon is always hard. Like, it is, like, it's a long way. But I think you can just, like, I find if you just break it down into the different chunks of it, then you can, I think, process it a bit more in terms of just get through 5K at a time. That seems quite manageable.
I think there's something really interesting there to kind of put a parallel into work, is sort of when you have that really big project or that really big promotion or that really big thing that you're pushing for, it is hard and it is hard work. And yes, you probably have the skills, you probably have the, you know, the sneakers, as I would say, or the runners, or whatever language you want to use. And actually, you know, breaking it down into those chunk size bites allows you to get through to the next stage and kind of, instead of seeing it in the whole, seeing in the chunks. And I think psychologically that really helps, not only in sport, but also in the business world as well.
Yeah, 100%. I think, I found so many parallels between sort of sport and work. I think it's probably one of the reasons that I was actually able to go, like, to go pro. Because I think when I set myself up to go part-time, so at the end of 2019, when I was like, right, I'm going to take this step, and made like a part-time role, I think my boss at the time appreciated that I needed the sport to be able to do my work in a good way. And I think the kind of the strengths that you can take from each, like, I think for me, when I was working full-time, and at that point it was in a very like intense job of like quite long hours, quite intense, or quite high level at, you know, like helping get stuff ready for the exec committee, it's, I found for me having the mental release of sport super important, but also some of the other things that I took from, okay, if I want to get this training session in, but I've also got to be in the office by 7, so I've got to get up at this time, and then this is how I've got to organize myself, like all of those little things that I took from sport to then make me better at my job. I think like my boss could kind of appreciate that, to be like, okay, I get that actually you're going to be a better employee from doing some of the sport stuff and some of the skills you bring from that. And then I think likewise, some of the, I think like mental resilience, some of organization, some of the other, I think also some of the kind of stakeholder management as well. Like there's obviously, I think like we'll come on probably to talk about it a bit more later, but negotiating things with companies to try and get sponsorship agreements, some of that stuff, like having the kind of more corporate background has definitely helped in that. So yeah, there's like, I've taken a lot of things from both sides and brought them across to the other, which has been super helpful.
I love that. And you know, we're talking about balancing on a seesaw. And I think one of the things you mentioned there, that organization piece is probably key when you're trying to do this, because as you said, if you've got to be at work, you got to be at work at a certain time and you still have to train and there's only 24 hours in a day. So it's actually, how does that look and how does that feel for you? Can I just go back? You quit full time. So you haven't quit your job, still working there, but you stopped working full time in 2017?
2019.
Okay. So actually, yeah, when you were doing the Ironmans, when you were starting to get into the triathlons, when you were doing all that, you were doing them simultaneously for quite a while.
Yep.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So let's kind of go back and then we'll come back to here. So we've started the tri clubs, we've done the Berlin Marathon. You ended up landing in, we just did a whole season on playing the cards you were dealt. And I feel like you were dealt this card of like, here, go run a triathlon. We have a space for it, which is so incredible. And so you went and did that triathlon. How did you do in that first triathlon, just out of curiosity?
I actually can't remember. But I feel like I must have done quite well, otherwise I probably wouldn't have enjoyed it. But yeah, I actually don't know.
Okay.
I think the main thing was I finished it and I must have been nearer the front than the back. Otherwise, I can't imagine that I would have come away enjoying it that much. But I think also it was the day when they used to do London and it was massive. They had a day that was like all of the age groupers and some of the pros. And then the next day was all for corporates. And we were doing it on the corporate day. So I think they might have also had a bit of a different way of kind of, I don't know, not scoring you, but I think it didn't feel as much like the competition as if I'd done it in the day before. So that probably also helped that I was only racing corporate people. So yeah, like, as I said, I think I must have done quite well, but I actually don't remember.
Yeah. And just to be clear, because I have this image of like people in suits running along, it's actually corporate sponsorship as opposed to necessarily people working in corporates, or is it actually everybody has to work in a corporate?
No, I think it was all corporate places. I think everyone, you know, I think all of our people were people from Lloyd's doing it. And I think, you know, it was then like people from like JP Morgan or, so it was all, hence the like, I think there were less super sporty people because I think most of the like really serious triathletes would have raced the day before as like the proper age group race.
And probably worked at JP Morgan and Lloyd's as well, because they're all A-type personalities who would have the high power jobs and be doing the triathlons on the weekends.
Yeah.
I love it. Okay. So we're doing our first, and what year was that for your first triathlon?
That was 2013.
Okay. So we've done our first triathlon in 2013. You've moved from Essex into London, joined the tri clubs in order to kind of make some friends. You've got the bug. And you're seeing that you might be able to race for GB. You're seeing this might be something that might become professional. So tell me a bit about your story from 2013 and maybe up until you sort of did your first Ironman. Actually, wait, I want to ask a question before you do that. What's the difference between a triathlon and an Ironman for those listening?
So Ironman is just the brand, but most people would have heard of it because it's the long one. So a normal Ironman, which might also be referred to as a full distance, is 3.8k swim, 180k bike, and a marathon. What most people would refer to as a triathlon, I guess, would be like the Olympic distance, which is the distance that's in the Olympics, which is 1.5k swim, 40k bike, and a 10k run.
Okay.
But there's then all sorts of different distances. So triathlon generally can just be like any distance, but yeah, Ironman is usually what most people would refer to as that, like full distance. But Ironman is generally just the brand that kind of coined that distance. There are now other brands that also do full distance. It like gets basically gets very complicated, but an Ironman is also a triathlon. It's just the long one, basically.
Okay. So when we say triathlon, what we're referring to is there's going to be an element of swimming, there's going to be an element of biking, and there's going to be an element of running. And then there are different distances. So some people do like mini triathlons, which might be like a 5K, you know, 20K, 5K, whatever, something like something, probably not a 5K swim, but you know, one lap at the pool, a little bike riding, and a run around the track, my kind of triathlon. So we've got different kinds of triathlons. The Ironman is the big one. I know like in marathons, they have like Marathon du Sable, which is like the running through the desert. Do you have anything that's like the super intense Ironman triathlon that's like the ultimate one that people are aiming to do?
So I think the ultimate Ironman is the one in Hawaii, because that's where it started. And that is the world champs usually, although again, they've now changed it a little bit, so it's got a bit more complicated. But generally every year in Hawaii in October, they have the world championship. You have to qualify for it. It used to be very hard to get a qualification slot. It's now not as hard because it's so expensive. So the slots can kind of roll down a bit more, and it's basically more of a who can afford it, which is a different issue. But yeah, so that I think is the ultimate kind of longer distance one. And that was what basically made me do my first Ironman, because I'd heard people at the club talking about Kona. And I was like, what is this Kona thing people are talking about? And it is a pretty magical place out there. It's probably not my favorite place to do a triathlon because it's hot, it's humid, it's windy, it's really hard. But you'll like go in the sea for a little swim, and you'll just get this big pod of wild dolphins that swim up to you. It's like, it's a pretty magical place. But yeah, I'd say that's probably what most people who start triathlon and end up doing the full distance like Ironman, that's probably what most people are kind of, if they could get to Kona, they'd be pretty happy.
Cool. I was born in Hawaii, so I agree it's a completely magical place. But I was born in Oahu, not on the Big Island, so a little bit different. But yeah. Okay, so we've gone to 2013. We're headed towards 2017. Tell me a bit about this build up towards your first Ironman.
Yeah, so 2014 was when I'd kind of just joined the club, started doing all the like training sessions they were offering. And at that time, there was like a London league of lots of sprint distance and Olympic distance triathlons. And I basically just went and did as many of them as I could. So I wanted to race. Racing was fun. And I reckon like halfway through that year was when I realized that I might be able to compete for GB. But the way that that works is there are certain races you have to qualify for. So the 2014 sort of grand final, or like the championship, you basically had to race in 2013 to qualify for it. So I couldn't qualify for 2014, but I found the races in 2014 that I had to do to qualify for 2015. I managed to qualify both for the duathlon and the triathlon championships in 2015. So I went out and did those, and they were challenging, I would say. So for someone, as I said, I can swim. Swimming is not one of my strengths. I didn't do enough of it as a youngster to actually be quite good. And at the sort of Olympic distance and sprint distance triathlons, I think in some ways the swim is more important, because if you lose some of that initial time, it's just there's not enough distance to make it up. So yeah, I basically found in 2015 when I went out to Chicago to do this, like the final, I think I probably lost like 2-3 minutes to the people at the front on the swim. And I was basically like, I'm not sure that I'm ever going to be that good at this Olympic distance stuff. So then from that point, I was like, maybe I'll look at some of the longer distance ones. So there's like also half Ironman distance. So that's what I then did in 2016. And I went out and raced again. They've got like a half distance world championship that was out in Australia. And like, that was all good. But again, I was like, by this time I'd heard more people just talking about Kona. And I was like, well, I'm obviously just going to have to try and go there. Like that seems to be like a much bigger deal than the 70.3 world champs. And I was still at this point finding that actually the longer the race, probably the better for me, because I have more time on the bike and the run to kind of catch people up. The 2017 first Ironman, I decided to do it in Lanzarote because I knew that my ultimate goal was getting to Kona. I was like, well, if I do it in Lanzarote, it's kind of similar. Like, it's hot, windy, yeah. It's hilly. Like, if I can do it there, then I'll have more confidence that I can go to Kona and it won't feel as hard. My coach was like, that's a really stupid idea. It's like, you should definitely choose an easier one. But I'm quite stubborn. So I was like, I'm going to go do Lanzarote. And it was awful. Like, I think I over-carbo-loaded. I was sick in the swim. I then didn't have a great tummy on the bike. And the run was literally just get to every single port-a-loo that I could find. So it was not the best first Ironman. But I got really lucky in that, so at that point, and it's still kind of the case now, but generally speaking, in the female age groups, you have one slot to the World Championship because they're like limited, or like some of the age groups might have two, but generally speaking, there was one slot. And I ended up third in my age group, but the lady that had won already had a slot, and the lady that came second decided she didn't want it. So the slot rolled to me. So I got my Kona slot. I was like, brilliant. Wow. So I'm going to make it. And I was also a bit like, well, it can't be as bad as this race has been. Like, this race has been so miserable, but surely it will get better. So went out to Kona that year and had like a pretty decent race. I think I ended up third. I was third in my age group. And I think I was like the 10th age group overall. So I was like, okay, that's kind of not too bad for the second Ironman.
And also I just want to stop for 1 second. You're in Lanzarote, you are like vomiting and getting sick all along, and you still finish third. Like, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I did all right. So, yeah, I think with Ironman, if you basically, because I have this conversation with quite a lot of people who are like, I could never do it. I think because it's such a long day, actually, if you've got the right mentality and you can just keep moving forward, you can actually still do quite well. Because like, I think a lot of people just suffer from, I don't know, if you start getting into a bad way quite early on in the run or like halfway through the bike, it just seems like such a ridiculously long way. I think it just becomes a bit impossible. But yeah, I think going back to the like breaking it down into small chunks, for me, when I was doing that, I was like, just get to the next port-a-loo. That's all you need to do. Just get, then you can like have a little break. So yeah, it paid off. Yeah, then had like quite a good first Kona. But that then basically obviously gave me the bug of like, I need to come back and I need to win. And at this point, I then started seeing some professional women in particular, because it happens more on the female side than on the men, that kind of had come from corporate backgrounds or not sporting backgrounds and had turned pro sort of in their 30s and were doing quite well. So I guess probably, 2017 time is when I started thinking, oh, like that could be an option. Like it could be something I could look at. And it seemed like quite a good life. I was like, I could travel around to all these cool places, just do some racing, spend most of my time outdoors training. But I had in my head, I was like, I don't think I can justify to myself going pro until A, I'm in a like senior enough position at the bank to make it easy if I stepped away to come back in. Mm-hmm. And B, I was like, I want to be the overall age group winner in Kona, because then I'll feel like I've like justified getting my pro license. And there are also, there's also to get your pro license, every federation has slightly different qualifying things you have to do. And the British one is it's probably a little bit harder than some of the other ones. But one of the ways you could get it was by winning in Kona. So I was a bit like, then I would have like ticked off lots of different things. So 2018, went back to Kona, won my age group, was third overall. So I was like, I'm still not quite there. And I must have been a few months into my job, the like more intense job at that point, which I was loving as well. So I was also like, I want to do this job for more because I'm enjoying it. It's good. Like I absolutely loved my boss at that point. He was great to work for. So I was like, I'll give it another year, and then 2019 will be my hopefully go and win, and then I can go pro and I can kind of figure out what I'm doing with work after that. So, and I did. So 2019 I went and I won, and I was like, right, I can go pro now.
So 2019 you went back to Kona and you won the whole thing. You beat all the females in every age group. You were number one.
Yeah, other than the pros. Obviously the pros are like different race.
But. Okay. So pros in a different race. So, and you're going for your pro license. So this is sort of the last sort of amateur thing. And once you've won, and did you have to win in your, did you have to win your age group to get the pro license, or did you have to win to get the pro license?
You just had to win your age group.
Okay. So you'd already done that. So I could have taken it. Yeah. But that wasn't good enough for you. So you needed to go back and win the whole thing to prove it to yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And just to be clear, during all of this time that you are paying for all the trips out to Hawaii, you're paying for your own equipment, you're paying for, you know, anything else that you need, your coach, you talked about a coach, I imagine you had a physio. So this is like a massive expense that you're having to fund.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then
and it still is.
And it's, oh, it still is. Okay. All right. So, and then you're working your job. And, but at this point, you're kind of, how are you transitioning? So part of this, you know, the entire season's about balancing on the seesaw. So it feels like we've had a lot of conversation around what we've been doing outside of work. How many hours a week do you think you were dedicating to doing triathlons and preparing for triathlons and all that?
I think on average, I was probably training about 15 hours a week. And at that point, I was probably working between 50 and 60 hours a week.
Wow.
So, and a lot of people, and so then, because the people are often like, well, how did you manage it? And actually from a balancing act, I don't think I'm the best example, because all I was doing was working or triathlon. I didn't really have anything. I basically chose training, and I had like a couple of the training sessions were social, so I guess they were with the tri club, so I was kind of seeing that as my social time. But like I missed quite a lot of family things because I was like, I'm training or I'm racing or I've chosen to go and do this. I definitely let my relationship suffer. Like I actually ended up getting divorced at the end of 2019, so I'd also say definitely didn't get that balance right. And I wasn't really getting enough sleep. So, yeah, I actually coach a few age group triathletes now. And often the conversation is, oh, but I need to fit this in and that in. And it's like, well, from every perspective, like both the training and a work and a general mental health perspective, like sleep is the most important thing. I'd much rather you cut back your training by like half so you can get more sleep. So I think like I managed what I was doing because it was for a relatively short amount of time, because it ended up being, I guess, basically like 18 months, but probably the first 6 months of that, I wasn't training as hard. And I had like a few ups and downs of like when I was training more, when I was training less. I actually also had like a big bike crash in August of 2019. So I then actually had a like enforced sort of four or five weeks of not really training, which I actually think really helped me in height. Like it obviously wasn't very pleasant at the time, but looking back, I think that probably helped me win because I had like this enforced rest rather than trying to juggle everything. Yeah, I think like I look back at how I was managing stuff and like, yeah, I was very organized. I was very efficient. Like I got to a point where I'd have all my stuff ready and I'd get the alarm going off and I'd be out the door in like 5 minutes. Like I was pretty good at getting myself up for that. But yeah, if I talk about the kind of broader balance from a healthy everything else perspective, yeah, it definitely wasn't the best.
And I mean, just hearing your story, it feels like you were very single-minded in this desire to win, in this desire to head towards the triathlon and Kona very specifically. We were very, very single-minded about that. And I think often that can happen when you are passionate, when you're driven, when you're focused, when you want something and that is your desire. And I think it's almost like that little bit of an alarm, of a warning bell is with that comes the repercussions of being single-minded. And so what's really interesting is you had the bike crash, which was, you know, this enforced rest, but it was almost like you needed some kind of a bike crash earlier, potentially, to get you back into that sort of that position of being able to balance the things that you wanted to out. But what I want to challenge you on here is, like, yes, you sacrificed a lot for it, but was it worth it in terms of, if you were to go back and do it again, would you still do the same thing or would you do it differently? Hard question, I know.
That's a really hard question, because I think, like, where I am now, I probably had to do all that to get here. And I definitely would say I'm in, like, a way happier place. Yeah, it's really hard to know. I think I could have done. I guess I don't want to think I should have gone and done it differently. I think I can look back and I can take the learnings of, like, these are the things that I need to prioritize. These are the things that I know that when I get single-minded, I can let slip or ignore. I guess I'm obviously set up now in a much better way of how, as in, I've made life much easier to juggle because I've just taken lots of things out, which, so I have way more time.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I think a lot of it just comes back to having that ability to sit down and work out, like, what are your priorities? Like, if it is family, if it is triathlon, if it is work, I'm working out the kind of, if that is your priority, how are you like enabling yourself to focus on that? And almost, so I think even if I'd sat down and kind of recognized these are the things that I'm letting slip, you can then kind of ask yourself, like, am I happy with that? Like, is that, like, am I okay with the fact that I'm just ignoring my relationship, for example? Like, am I okay with that? Which, this, if I was looking at that now and I saw that, I'd be like, no, I'm not okay with that. So I'm going to change.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, like you said, you know, it's very easy when you have lots of different commitments to not give yourself the time or space to think about that and just literally be like, oh, I'm just going to do everything. Because I think also the other thing was, there was a huge part of me that enjoyed being super busy and people always being like, oh my God, how do you juggle everything? And I was like, yes, I'm like superwoman, but it's like, I'm not, like, and you shouldn't be expected to be. But I think there's a whole sort of societal pressure, especially on women, to be able to, like, juggle everything, or to kind of be like, oh, you're only really good if you're a mum who's also working, who's also doing all this other stuff, and she's also looks amazing, you know, like, there seems to be this whole, like, narrative of, like, oh, she's doing it all. But it's like, actually, I think in reality, very few people manage to do it all. And if they do, it's probably because they've probably got some kind of extra support system that doesn't get talked about. Whereas I think, like, the narrative around it is like, oh, like, look at her, she's amazing, like, she works and she's like, blah. So there's definitely a big part of me that also liked that. You know, coming into work and people being like, oh, like, what have you, like, how long have you been up? And I'd be like, oh, I woke up at like 4:30 and I've already done like a 2-hour training session. Like, look at me, I'm so great. Which is like, that shouldn't really be celebrated that much. Like, it's not that healthy. Yeah, like, lots of, like, learnings. But I think, yeah, I don't think I'd go back and change it, because I think where I am now, I probably had to go through all of that to get here. But there are definitely lots of things I've taken from that time to make me a healthier, more balanced person going forward.
That's is like such a great response, because it's not about regrets, it's about what's the learning we take from it. And I think there's something that's incredibly poignant about what you said around that badge of honor of all-nighters, of waking up early, of getting it all done, of being, you know, whatever it is that whatever this impossible thing that society expects of us. And I think social media just feeds this even more so, because, you know, again, we all know, oh, this is the highlight reels. We all know it's people putting their best face forward, but it does. It looks like everybody else has it together. And so you're constantly feeling like, I'm the one who's failing. But actually, what's happening behind the scenes there? I often tell the story about a girl who I knew was about to get divorced, or her whole relationship was falling apart. And on Instagram, they had just bought a new beach house and they were out there and dressed in beautiful coordinated clothing and looking perfect. And look at our new beach house and look how amazing it is. And I'm like, yeah, but if you could see what was going on behind the curtain, it's not even remotely what they're projecting out. And I think so often we to ourselves are so mean to ourselves and so unfair to ourselves because we're trying to strive for this perfection. And then we then project that onto other people because we want them to see us as being perfect as well, just as you just said. And I just, Ruth, I think there's just so much wisdom in what you just said. And I love the learnings that you've taken and the questions that you're asking. And I was going to say the issue that happens when you're in that single-mindedness, when you're in that push, when you're trying to get to whatever that goal is actually don't have that time. You don't think you have that time to sit and reflect and say, am I making the right choices here? Are these the priorities I want to have? I coach people often where I say, you are running full speed down a road. What's at the end of the road? What are you running towards? And do you even want that? And a lot of times people don't even take the time to think about, you know, what is at the end of this road? Like, what am I losing along the way? What am I running past? What am I not seeing? What am I not experiencing? So I love that. Thank you so much for sharing the very honest reflection. And I really think that's going to resonate with people that are listening. So you're in a state where you're working a lot. You are training a lot. You are finding some really good ways to do that as well. Like, let's just bring out the positives around. I love the fact that you said you're able to get out the door in 5 minutes. Like, how many of us can do that? I can't get out the door in an hour and a half. Sometimes it's 2 hours. It's like, it's especially with 2 children. I never get out the door. Actually, I'm just dragging people out the door. But you, that whole idea of being organized and efficient. So what were some of the things you did have in place that really helped you?
Yeah, I think my main thing was just getting everything ready the night before. And that was stuff like making sure like my bag was packed, that was ready. Anything that I needed to get dressed into was next to the bed ready. I did like a lot of meal prep as well, because I was also trying to cut down on having to go out. Like, a lot of the time at work, I would try and not really do like a lunch hour as such. It would maybe be like I'd go and swim or run or like something. And then I'd be like, well, I obviously have to have lunch like ready. So I'm then not taking an extra 15-20 minutes to go out and get lunch. And I was also trying to eat relatively healthy, so that also seemed, and save some money, because as you said, I was spending a lot of money on triathlons. So lots of different things going into that. So yeah, meal preps, I did like a huge batch of that at the weekend. I think sometimes for like, if it was training, I would quite often try and have other people I was meeting to be like, I can't be late because I'm meeting someone. That's the other desire, I think. If you don't have that pressure, sometimes you can be like, oh, I'll just take like an extra couple of minutes. And then if that's, I'm going to take an extra couple of minutes in bed, then it's basically impossible to get out of bed. I never let myself snooze the alarm. That was like, I cannot do that, otherwise I won't get up. Yeah, I think they were the main ones, really. And I think just knowing, I think when you've had a couple of successful races, that feeling of crossing the finish line, it's kind of like, it's just bottling that up and being like, anytime you're having not a great day or not a great session, thinking back to that and being like, I know it's worth it, because that feeling of crossing the finish line, having had a good race, is like more than worth it. But yeah. And then I think I just did other things I could. So one of my main challenges when I was doing that job was getting time with my boss to actually go through everything we had to go through. So I was basically his like business manager. And because his whole day was pretty much meetings, that was usually why I had to be in at 7, because it would be like, that would be my one gap of catching him and being able to talk through the day, talk through what we had to do, get any feedback on stuff that I needed feedback on. But yeah, we often also had, you know, there were some days where that couldn't happen, but I'd be like, well, I'm going to be on the turbo doing a session at this time, so I'll talk to you while you're getting driven in at like 6:30 in the morning or whatever it is. I remember some people being like, why are you like, you shouldn't be agreeing to that. And I was like, oh no, I suggested it, because actually it works way better for me than trying to get in. So I think it's also knowing what are some of the things that work better for you, which might not necessarily sound like the best, but finding ways of, I guess, making some of that time, making it fit your timeframes more. Because I think often as well, it's easy to get sucked into the, this is the norms of how we work. Whereas I actually think now, probably like post-COVID has probably been quite a good readjustment of people actually feeling more comfortable to ask for more. Because I think a lot of the time it's like, you might as well ask, because the worst that's going to happen is someone's going to say, no, you can't work in that way, or we can't do that. But I had this whole conversation with people of when I first went part-time, because I basically just created my own job. I was like, what can I do on like 1 or 2 days a week that I won't end up working way more than that? So I was like, I think a lot of the roles, there's a lot of roles, especially in like kind of financial institutions, that are pretty difficult to do on reduced hours. So I basically just created a role and I was like, this is the role that I think I can do that I'd still think adds benefit, and proposed it to my boss. And he was like, yeah, okay. And loads of people were like, how did you manage that? I was like, I just asked. Like, you can only ask. And if they say no, they say no, but at least you've tried. And I think as long as you recognize the flexibility of trying to make it work both ways, I think that's like, because it's also it's easy to get caught up in your world and be like, well, this is what's best for me. But then, you know, if you're working with a team or whatever, it's also trying to think about how does it also work for them? Mm. So yeah, I think there was definitely all of this stuff I did to make life easier to get out the door and minimize time wasted doing stuff. But then there was also the, from a work perspective, what else can I do to make that more efficient? And yeah, I basically like tried to cut out as much dead time as possible.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that kind of efficiency. So each one of us is given 24 hours in a day. And the question is, how are you using it? And how much time, you know, when you say I don't have time for that question, how much time are you on social media? How much time are you watching TV? You know, how much time are you taking doing whatever it is that you're doing? And actually, or can you use that time better? And are there more efficient ways to use your time? And sometimes you do. Sometimes you need to just sit down on the couch and watch TV because you need to decompress. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if that's part of your schedule every day and you're feeling like you need more time, that's a great place to find it. I also love the idea of ask, you know, the worst they can say is no. And I want to add to that also, then they have an idea of what you want. And so they can help to make that more of a reality. So even if you'd gone and said, I want to do this, I'm thinking about this, and they said, that's not going to work. We don't have the FTE. We don't have the budget, you know, all the kind of responses. Let's work together to find out a solution, because they know what you're actually aiming towards, which is really helpful. And as you say, you know, the worst they're going to say is no. And you can find other options. You can find other ways to do things. So you got your pro license in 2018, 2019?
End of 2019.
Okay, so really great timing, because nothing major happened in 2020. So
really good timing. Yeah, just for the kind of sport where you need to travel and totally. Go to other countries
and be with a whole bunch of other people. Yeah. And yeah, that's just perfect. So 2019, we decide to go pro. Have you cut your hours way back then at that point, or are you? So what's happened? Where are we now in terms of the balance between hours?
Yeah, so it was end of 2019. So the Kona race was mid-October, and I basically got back from that and had the initial conversation with my boss to then start going really part-time in January. And basically in the meantime, I then had to find my replacement, because again, I was like, I appreciate that I need to find someone to replace me. But yeah, that was like the rest of 2019. And then it was from January 2020 that I went part-time. I went to 1 day a week, but actually quite quickly that didn't feel enough. I basically spent 1 day doing emails, catching up on stuff, and never actually getting around to doing any work. So yeah, probably like within like 3-4 weeks, I was like, this isn't working. But I don't like, because I was finding it frustrating, so I was like, I'm not managing to do anything. So quite quickly, but then went up to 2 days a week. But what was quite good is I had the flexibility to sort of spread that across the week. So yeah, basically it wouldn't have worked from a training perspective, just doing 2 solid days of work and then nothing. And actually from a business perspective, it was more helpful to spread it across as well. Because then like I wasn't only in for like 2 days a week. I guess I was like more responsive across the weeks. It's actually a bit easier from both angles. So yeah, I basically spent the first part, those like first 3 months in 2020, just training, catching up on sleep. I think that's probably the most important thing that I did those first 3 months. And then, yeah, COVID hit. Actually, again, it was probably a really good thing for me from my triathlon career, because it just gave me longer to train before racing. Because I think one of the things that people also underestimate from a sport like triathlon, where it's kind of more endurance based, is actually you sort of need time, and time being consistent to get anywhere. Yeah, I mean, I was lucky. I actually moved in with then of my sort of very new boyfriend at the time, because he had a sort of endless pool, so he could still swim. And I was basically like, I can't go through any time of not swimming. It's my weakest. Like, I might as well give up on being a professional triathlete if I can't swim for, like, to be fair, like at that point we thought it was maybe going to be like a month. So I was like, yeah, I'll just come like stay with you for a month. That then turned into like 6 months. I was like, I'm still here. But yeah, so like 2020, I kind of just built the base. We actually did like a few little adventure things of like going off gravel riding. And yeah, like it was actually, I quite enjoyed 2020. And then we obviously had a few races towards the end of the year. Then I started feeling a little bit more like a professional triathlete. But actually my main sort of learning in 2020 was also, I was like pretty thankful that I hadn't taken a sabbatical, that I'd kept some work, because like a sabbatical had been one of my other options of of going pro. But actually I was like, it works quite well, the balance of having something to think about that's not triathlon related, because I think otherwise you get quite insular. It can also then, I don't know, if you get injured, if you don't have anything else, it's quite hard to have any kind of perspective. So yeah, it actually made me think it's good to have something else. But yeah, like it just, yeah, at the time it didn't feel like great timing with COVID. But then I also think like the good thing of COVID, like COVID put everything into perspective, really, in many ways. I was like, well, I'm healthy. I'm doing all the things that I like doing. I get a bit of bonus racing towards the end of the year. I've still got a job. Like, there were lots of good things. So yeah, it kind of worked all right in the end.
So use the time for COVID just to really get yourself up to training standards to be able to compete at a professional level, started competing at a professional level from the end of 2020. And so you're at the end of 2020. Now we're having this conversation, you know, 3 years later. So tell me a little bit about what's happened for you as a professional triathlete.
Yeah, it now feels like the last few years have been, like, lots has gone on. Yeah, I think the first, 2021 was probably then more of the year of actually getting to some bigger races, like stuff felt a little bit more back to normal from a racing perspective. There were still some ups and downs of like various countries that got red listed or that you couldn't really go to. But yeah. I ended up doing, I did like a couple of Ironmans toward the end of the year. I'd also been a little bit injured, so I had like a calf injury that took a while. But yeah, I managed to win my first professional Ironman, which was...
Wow!
That was nice. That felt
That's
like...
huge!
Yeah, that was definitely like a good one. Yeah, so I think like 2021 felt like more of the transitional year of, I've actually finally had that base. I feel like it's coming through now. I feel like I can actually be a bit more competitive. Like the couple of races that I did at the end of 2020, I still felt quite far away from sort of being a competitive pro. Like I felt like I was enjoying it, but I was like quite far behind from being competitive. And then 2021, I felt like, okay, I'm kind of getting closer to that point again now. And then 2022, we ended up having, they had to delay the world champs from 2021 to 2022, basically because of COVID. So we had one We actually ended up having two world championships in 2022. But the one in like May, that was the early one, that was the Hanover from 2021. That one actually went really well. So I came fifth at that one. And I was like, oh, I kind of feel like I'm where I want to be. Like I'm up at like the pointy end. It's great. Then the rest of that year was not as great. I then had another little niggling injury. We then had the back to like the normal Kona World Champs in October. And I just had a terrible day. Just one of those days where like nothing felt like it was firing. So then didn't feel like that was great. But then I did another race towards the end of the year and won that one. So like ended 2022 on a high note. And then this year has just been terrible from a, again, basically just been injured like all year. So I haven't really done much racing until recently, which I then went back out to Kona for the World Champs. Again, I didn't have like my best day, but I had an all right day and ended up coming 12th, which considering I basically haven't been able to race all year, I don't know, obviously I've kind of had hopes and dreams of I might have a pretty magical day and somehow end up somewhere near the top five. But yeah, considering the year that I've had, I was like, I got to race. I actually had a reasonable day. Like, yeah. So this year's been more challenging, but hopefully over some of the injury stuff now. And yeah, hopefully like set myself up for a bit of a better 2024.
And you've just gotten back from Kona, is that right? As we're having this conversation. Yes. Okay. So feeling the time lag as well as coming off the back of that and having the injuries and all the rest of it. With the kind of move into pro then, so do you actually end up making money off of races, like depending on where you come in? Do you only make money if you win? Do you make money from sponsors? Like how do you actually make money as a pro triathlete?
Yeah, it's challenging. Yeah, so like you said, there's prize money, which depends on the race. But like a reasonable size Ironman, you're probably getting paid usually like the top 5 to 8. Like you might get somewhere between sort of 10 and 12 grand for winning, and down at the bottom, probably like $500. That all gets taxed before you get it. So it ends up not being as much. You also have to pay for all the travel, all the accommodation, et cetera. So yeah, you can imagine
which
that.
Which is about $10,000 in itself.
Yeah. If you're going to Hawaii, you're basically not making any money. Through sponsors, there's like a couple of different, so you can either have like a base sort of cash sponsor agreement, but quite often you'll make more of the money through like podium bonuses. Again, kind of often linked to performance. Yeah, that's probably the main thing. But then obviously, like again, with sponsors, that is generally like you can get an agent, but doesn't like agents take 20%. So like for me at the moment, I don't have an agent because I don't feel like I'm making enough money from contracts to make it worth it. So I negotiate all my contracts, which is also quite a challenge. Part like mainly from a like how do you value yourself? So I think the benefit of being an agent is you see lots of different contracts. So you get a better idea of like, what's the kind of, you know, for the person that goes and wins the world championship, what are they getting versus someone who's maybe just winning other Ironmans? Whereas like, yeah, for me, I'm like, I obviously don't see any of those contracts. I'm like, I don't really know where to pitch myself from a, like, because you don't want to undervalue yourself, but you also don't want to overvalue yourself and go in way too high and then be like, who do you think you are? Yeah, that is quite a challenge. But I generally say, like, there's really not very much money in triathlon. Probably, like, the top 5 in the world are making, like, relatively decent money. But it was making me laugh because I saw something from some of, like, the tennis players talking about the fact that you can't make a living if you're outside the top 100. And I was like,
yeah, you're like, you got nothing.
Really make a, you can't really make a living in triathlon unless you're in the top 10. And even then, it's probably not a great living. So yeah, it's got a long way to go as a sport, I think, to properly professionalize it and get a bit more money in. But yeah, as I like, you know, that's obviously, I'm not doing it for the, like, I didn't get into triathlon, so I thought this is a great way of making some money.
Yeah.
I very much made sure I set up like a little nest egg of like savings before I went part-time. I'm obviously still working. Yeah, I basically made sure that I wanted to be able to do it in a way where it wasn't like a massive struggle. Because yeah, I was like, I still want to be able to eat, like go out for nice dinners or whatever occasionally. So yeah, that's been a challenge, but I knew it was going to be. So I was like prepared for that side of things.
Yeah. I had a mentor told me before I set off and started my own business. She said, you need to just set aside 1 year's salary to have available to you so that, you know, if things hit the fan, you have the money available so you're not worried about it, because otherwise you might cash in your chips and just go back to full-time employment. So it's sort of actually just having that off to the side allows you to be able to stretch that muscle. We're coming really close to end, but what I want to ask is like, what is next for you? What happens with Team GB as well? Because I know you were talking about the distance being better for you and the Ironmans and the long distances. Does that have anything to do with Team GB as well? Or is that something that might be coming up? Can we look for you, you know, on Team GB? Is there anything we can kind of see you in if you're going to be doing that? And, you know, also just sort of what's next for you?
Yes, I'm going to try and race probably another couple of times this year, just because I haven't really been able to race. So hopefully heading off to Mexico in a month for another Ironman. And then I'll probably do another half after that, depending on how the body pulls up. And then, yeah, hopefully heading into next year, just kind of be less injured would be nice and be able to race throughout the year. Yeah, so Team GB doesn't really exist for long distance. It's like completely independent. Team GB is basically for the Olympic distance. So you won't find me there. There's like a few weird little nuances to it. But yeah, basically nothing to do with Team GB. So yeah, it's like, but obviously next year is Olympic year. And actually one of the girls that I train with quite a lot has now stamped her place for the Olympics. So yeah, hopefully also get out to Paris and be able to watch the Olympics.
Wonderful. Yeah, I thought, because when you were talking about how your strength lies in having the longer distance, I was wondering what then happened with that pull towards Team GB. And it sounds like actually that's not your strength, and focusing on the Ironmans and focusing on the longer distance and really being able to pull out what you're good at, which is the biking and the running, and then you can make up for the swimming. So I also love that about your story, Ruth, is that, you know, there are parts of it where actually, yes, I do triathlons, but I recognize what I'm good at. And then you're able to kind of focus on that and just the learnings that you shared throughout all this and that balance, which, you know, you didn't maybe necessarily do so well at before, but actually now you're able to really pull yourself up on, ask yourself the hard questions, and then kind of try and find that rebalance. So this has been a phenomenal conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your story with me and with our audience.
No worries. It's been great.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Join me next time when I speak to a guest about how they are balancing on the proverbial seesaw. If you're looking for an executive coach, facilitator, or keynote speaker, or just want to get in touch, check out my website, kljconsulting.co.uk, or shoot me an email on the undiscoveredyoupodcast@gmail.com. If you're enjoying the podcast and would like to support me in putting out more content, why not buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/undiscoveredyou. Don't forget to follow, subscribe, like, and comment below. And I hope that you're one step closer to discovering the undiscovered you.